This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. This is Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds from around the world. Brought to you by lineupmedia.fm. Now your host, former USA Baseball National Team Coach, Peter Caliendo.
Hello, everyone from around the world, and thanks for joining us on another great episode of Baseball Outside the Box. This is the show that brings you the most innovative thoughts from baseball's best coaching minds who love to challenge the status quo. Hello, and I am your host, Pete Caliendo. We are thrilled that you're listening to another show. We have another thriller for you. We try to bring you the best in business, the most creative people we can find. But before we start, special thanks to our producer, Brian Kroc, with the Lineup Media Group. Go to Lineup Media Group. Listen to all their podcasts. They've got so many in so many fields. They're leading, fastest leading podcast right now anywhere. All right. The show you know is free. And if you like it, we ask you some favors. Please do us a favor. Go to Twitter at Baseball Out and also our Facebook, Baseball Outside the Box. Forward that to all your friends. Follow us. That really helps us with the show. Of course, we're trying to get all this information out to as many baseball people anywhere in the U.S. and around the world. Also, if you're a new listener, thank you for joining the show. We will do our best to make sure that the show is very informative and you learn a lot, take a lot of notes. Do us a favor, go to baseballoutsidethebox.com, join the show, either iTunes or Stitcher, hit the logo. And if you're a loyal listener, thank you, because of you, the show continues. You can do us a favor, go to iTunes and Stitcher, hit that logo again, and give us a 5-star rating. That really helps the show. It helps it get out, you know, get it out and let people know about it. So, all right, we are excited, as always. We're always excited about our show. The topic today, coaching baseball and the impact of a player and coach relationship. But we're also going to have, on the second part, we're also going to talk about pitching, because our friend here, our guest that I'm going to introduce in a minute, is a specialist also in pitching. Let me tell you about a little bit about him. Jonathan Armold, he's the pitching coach. He's one of the pitching coaches with the Texas Rangers. He started off at Flagler College under a good friend of mine, Dave Barnett, outstanding baseball coach and program. Believe it or not, Jonathan was also on a trip of Caliendo Sports Team America in Italy right around 2006. We're going to ask him about that experience. Now, Jonathan's got a great, great background. And I recently saw him a couple years, I think it was, at the ABCA, and we finally caught up after so many years. He's one of the young people in the game of baseball that's got a great mind, and you'll know once you listen to him talk. He started his coaching career at the University of Texas at Dallas, where he got his master's degree in organizational behavior and executive coaching. All right. Then he went on to play with the Milwaukee Brewers. He was a 30th round pick. He was a then pitching coach at Texas Marshall, served the pitching coach during 2014 with the Texas Collegiate League Summer. He also was the pitching coach at Texas Dallas. And finally, he's one of the minor league coaches at Texas, the Texas Rangers. But he's also spoken around the country. Recently spoke at the Ron Wolford's Baseball Ranch at a specially invited convention where some of the top experts are invited by Ron Wolford. All right, so let's get rolling because we want to get you all this great information. So let me welcome a great, great friend, Jonathan. How you doing, man?
Good, doing well. Thank you for having me.
All right, great, great having you. I know you're in Arizona, so we got a little time zone here. And you got, you're getting ready because you got some things going on today, obviously, with the Rangers. I think you guys are finishing up. So we'll get started. And first of all, just give the audience. I want you to tell our audience a little bit around the world, because Caliendo Sports, you know, we still take teams around the world for baseball, softball, and other sports and cultural aspect. Give them an idea a little bit about the trip that you went on with us. I know it was a long, long time ago, but anything you think of that kind of influenced your career within that trip, possibly.
Definitely. It kind of just the experience, really, of being able to go overseas, going to Italy, checking out different culture, different types of food. I had the privilege of going over there with you and went over there with my dad, too. So just getting to experience a really cool, you know, vacation while at the same time being able to play some baseball against some good talent from Italy. that I never would have had the experience to play otherwise. And it was really interesting. You know, I actually think back to it, and that was kind of my first taste into professional baseball, actually, where, you know, you're traveling, you're hopping on a bus, and then you're playing a game. It was really interesting in just about every aspect: the food, the culture, the people, getting to know a handful of different coaches that came with us on that trip, and then a bunch of different players from around the country at the same time. Just all in all, a really good experience that hadn't had that type of experience beforehand.
Sure. And you know what? It's interesting you say some of that, because we get a lot of emails from past players. And, you know, I remember, and this is going back a long time, I remember Jason Wirth, who, you know, was with the Nationals, currently now, I believe, with Seattle. We'll text back and forth once in a while. And, you know, and the first thing he talks about is the time he went to Brazil in an international event. And he still remembers it. And it was, you know, just had a great experience. So thanks for giving us that feedback a little bit on the trip. So let's do this. Now, you got into coaching, obviously. Let me ask you this. What got you into coaching? Why coaching? You know, because you became a professional player. Why didn't you go into something else?
That's a great question. To be honest, I'd never planned on getting into coaching. I'd actually planned on going to law school, whether I got drafted or not. If I didn't get drafted, I was just going to go straight to law school, but got drafted. So put law school on the back burner for a little bit, but knew it would always be there whenever my playing career was done. Got done playing, and I'd been doing some lessons and things in the off season, and just felt kind of a calling. Thought I'd had a great experience from a variety of coaches, whether it was Ron Wolforth at the Texas Baseball Ranch or Brent Strom, who's of course now with the Astros. Felt like I had something to offer, and felt like I could really make potentially a bigger impact in the coaching realm, where I have a little bit more experience, and knew that, you know, if push come to shove, I can always go back to law school, but I don't know that I can go from law school to a coaching career. So just got started that way, and ultimately decided, wasn't sure if I was going to be in college or pro ball. Ultimately decided to try to get my master's degree, and was able to do that while coaching. And really the relationships is a large portion of what got me started into that. I had a really great college coach between Coach Dave Barnett and my pitching coach, Coach Holt at the time, where created a really great relationship with me and made me think a little bit differently about coaching in the same vein.
Sure. And, you know, what's interesting is you've got a great background, because you come from the professional aspect, you know, in collegiate baseball. You've had some great coaches that you played for, obviously, and that helps a great deal with the knowledge base. But then all of a sudden you get into your master's degree into organizational behavior and executive coaching. Now that, the combination of both of those is going to lead into our topic, the first part of our topic, and hopefully we'll be able to get to the pitching, because this topic seems real exciting. So tell us about, you know, the impact of a player and coach relationship. Why did you gave that talk at Ron Wolford's program, and that program is some of the top people in the world that come there. Tell us about that talk a little bit. Why did you pick that? And what was some of the key important areas of what you discussed?
The big thing that I tried to bring in that conversation was, you know, I told Ron, I said, Ron, you know, I'd be more than happy. I would love to present and to speak. That was a convention I've been going to for a couple of years, and also felt like by that time I was literally graduating my master's degree the week before the presentation. I said, I think I can supply some value and some input from this degree. And really what it was Ron, you've got the mechanic stuff taken care of. You've got the training program stuff taken care of. You've got the actual physical aspects of baseball pretty well taken care of, how we can improve velocity, how we can improve arm health, how we can improve command. What I'd like to talk about is a little bit more of the communication aspect, a little bit more of how can you actually relay that information to players a little bit better. I think in a lot of instances, coaches are just kind of expected to be able to communicate well. And we all know, we've all had coaches that don't communicate very well, that it's harder for them to create relationships, and that's okay. But I think having the awareness that coaching is a dynamic social activity, it's not just something that's straight up given to a player. And being aware of that, being aware of personalities and how you can adjust and adapt the way that you coach in order to better deliver your message to the athlete, in order to better formulate your message to the athlete to really make the biggest impact. And that to me is what the player coach relationship is really more about.
And now, you know, when you look at it, and I know you just recently gave a talk to some of the coaches, I believe, at the Texas Rangers staff. And, you know, tell us where, as coaches, especially starting with the young kids, because I, you know, on this show, I talk about young kids all the time. You know, I believe that education should be strong at the younger levels, not at the higher levels. I mean, I think we need it at the higher levels, but I believe that if you don't get them young enough, you're just not going to get them developed well enough or even to stay in the game, because they're going to get disgruntled, and, you know, especially in a game like baseball. But tell us where we're failing as coaches. You know, we'll talk about how we're doing well too, but let's talk about how we're failing as coaches when we get them when they're young. What are some of the things we're doing that we think we're doing are correct, but possibly are not?
I think this is a big thing. And I know you had Crush on, I want to say last week or whenever you had Crush come on, he made a great point about it where, you know, we've got to keep the game fun. And I've heard it said a lot of times where sometimes coaching goes too far and it's almost like you'd be better off if you didn't have any coaches, because the coaching becomes this dictatorship where it's just I'm sitting from on high and telling you exactly what to do versus actually letting you self-discover and letting you learn and feel and understand for yourself rather than me just simply telling you. So my answer to that would be, instead of feeling that you as a coach always have to have all the answers, be comfortable not having the answers. I sat in a room or stood in a room and presented a lot of this stuff to some of our Ranger coaches that combined, they've all got way more coaching experience than me. And I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with admitting that. It's more, you know, starting a discussion. Hey, how can we do some things better? How can we communicate better? How can we open things up for our athletes rather than, you know, almost pretend that we have all the answers? So my biggest advice, especially to youth coaches, is let them play, you know, provide an environment and allow that environment to create more answers for the athlete than you always having to specifically give the answers to the athlete. If you can create more questions, you're doing a really good job as a coach rather than simply providing answers.
You know, that makes a ton of sense, doesn't it? I know as coaches, I think we tend to talk too much and not listen enough. And as you just said, not ask a lot of questions. And I know in the last 10 years, you know, I've gotten to the level where, you know, asking questions really, really works out, because it gives the player some entitlement, you know, where not entitlement, but where they belong, you know, where they believe that they're part of the process. You know, and you mentioned, sometimes, you know, I guess if you do have a really bad coach, or not so good of a coach, sometimes playing on your own. I remember we used to do that and I'm older than you are, but when I was growing up, you know, we played on our own and we learned so much on our own, you know, because just through the process of just doing it can be helpful. What do you guys do with the Rangers? This is something I'd like to find out. You guys amongst yourselves as coaches, you evaluate yourselves? Like, are there coaches that will come to you, or you go to them and say, hey, could you watch me do something and see how I'm doing and get feedback?
Definitely. I think we do that on the coaching side a lot where, you know, that's any sort of good culture, right? Where you can not criticize, but critique and give constructive feedback on how you're doing something, whether it's literally throwing a ball, like throwing batting practice. Hey, here's one thing I'm seeing. Here's maybe one thing you can do better to throw better BP. Or coaching. Hey, here's one thing I see that you're doing when you're coaching your athletes. What if we just reframe and rethink a little bit of the way that we're doing that? And it's like anything. It's just like everything that we're talking about with players. You know, you've got to deal with personalities, and some people are going to be a little bit more open to that than others. But finding a space to improve, finding a space to be able to communicate and talk about things, I think is huge. So definitely we have a space for that.
You know, and that's great, because I know with our international trips, you know, I get some coaches that are ABCA Hall of Fame coaches. I've known for 30 years. And, you know, they'll be coaching a team, and I'm sitting in the stands, and I'll be taking notes. And then afterwards, we talk about that. And obviously, you know, I'm looking at it from the outside in. It's a different perspective. But there's no egos involved, because, you know, these are coaches that have been around 30 years, and they're trying to get better all the time. So they have me sit in the stands and review what they're doing. And I don't have quite the experience they have, but it's a different perspective. Now, in your talk, you said, you know, I noticed a comment here. You said voice matters. Talk about that to our coaches. What do you mean by voice matters?
So you kind of hit on it a little bit, where you said the term entitlement. And I think what you really meant was empowerment and engagement.
Yes.
And that's fine. Just got tripped up where... You know, ultimately, it's not about how much we know. It's about what we can allow the athlete to know and help the athlete to know. And in order to do that, you know, they need to feel empowered and engaged in their own process. It's their process, after all, not necessarily ours. So voice matters. I'd actually taken that. It was from a study that they did in school children. And it was from the school voice report. And in, I think, 2016, 2015, somewhere around there. And they surveyed school children, students, and they asked them, you know, do you feel like you have a voice? Do you feel like you can talk to your teacher? You have some sort of impact in what goes on? You know, you're involved in the community or in the classroom, whatever's going on there. And what they found was that students who did feel they had a voice, they were 7 times more likely to be motivated to learn. They were 8 times more likely to experience engagement in the school. And they're 9 times more likely to experience purpose in the school. So you think about that and okay, little bit of a different situation. Those are actual teachers. But even more so, if anything, I think on our side of sport coaching, it needs to be even more opened up for them to have that motivation to learn, to have that engagement, and to feel that purpose. Because we say it all the time, it's your career, you know, do with it what you want, is what we're doing to help them actually allowing for that.
You know, along that same path, I want to ask you this, because I was watching a TV show last night. I mean, and it's really incredible how it, you know, it kind of fits with what you're talking. I was watching a TV show last night, and they were talking about in World War II, a lot of the kids used to play in some of the rubbles of the buildings that were, you know, blown up. And they were talking about risk management, saying that, you know, nowadays we don't allow kids to take some risks. You know, we're always so cautious. I mean, there's no learning process. And I'm not advocating, you know, they should be jumping off bricks. But, you know, we don't allow kids to really play the game on their own. You know, there's no growth. You know, how do you get stronger if you're not learning something, you know, on your own sometimes? Give us some advice. You know, what should coaches be doing when it comes to that? Because a lot of them, you know, even college baseball now, we got all these signals on our wrists, you know, and we're following these charts and these movements, and we're not playing the game. Maybe explain that a little bit.
Definitely. That's a great conversation to have. I think it ultimately comes down to reframing failure. Failure's okay. You're going to fail. We say it all the time about how, oh, you're going to strike out, or you're going to get out 7 times out of 10, and that's going to be a really good career, right? But then a lot of times we go into practice, and it's like if a hitter's not hitting every single ball off the back part of the cage or the back top part of the cage, if we're elevating the ball, if they're not doing that every time, then we're jumping on them. We're trying to throw in a cue that's going to get them back on track, instead of almost embracing that failure. I think especially in today's culture, today's society, for better or for worse, that failure is, oh, it can't happen. And you get athletes that just like us, you know, we get embarrassed of failing or worried about failing, especially in front of our peers, and kind of reframing that, understanding you know, it's okay to not know. It's okay to fail. It's more, what is your direction and what is your intention beyond that? Are you failing to grow, or are you just failing because you're not really putting in the time, putting in the effort, whatever? You make a great point. It's like a lot of the videos that you see of kids doing skateboard tricks, right? There's no coach there sitting there telling them exactly what to do in order to do the skateboard trick. They fail 50 times, fall on their face, and then ultimately they figure it out and they self-organize a little bit and they learn through that failure. And that's not to say this culture is any worse. It's just, how can we reframe some of that? And as coaches, provide the environment that allows it to be okay to fail.
Sure. And, you know, I love that failing to grow. I mean, that's a great line right there. You know, what are some of the things that you, with, you know, you got a lot of young guys with the Texas Rangers, you know, you probably have guys that are coming up as young as 18 years old. You know, what are some of the things that you guys work with some of your players? And, you know, I know you handle the pitchers and there's certainly failure at pitching. What are some of the things you work with some of your players when they do get down or when they do fail and aren't really sure how to react to the, you know, to the next inning or next pitch?
Definitely. I mean, I'm working with guys that are fresh out of the draft. I've been in the AZL, the Arizona League, Rookie League, these past two seasons. And then this next year, I'm going up to Spokane, which is short season rookie ball. So I'm dealing with a lot of young guys that maybe aren't used to that failure so much, especially the majority of them are coming from high schools where they dominated or colleges where they did really well enough to come to professional baseball. And I think a large portion of it is having some of these types of conversations. Hey, you know, okay, you failed. Well, let's dive into the failure and let's go to what actually made that happen. And I really credit a large portion of my understanding of that to this master's degree in organizational behavior, professional executive coaching, of understanding how to ask questions and how to listen a little bit better and just how to communicate a little bit more effectively where, okay, let's say a pitcher's throwing a bullpen and he throws, we're trying to locate a down and away fastball and he throws it and he misses arm side and he misses over the middle or inside part of the plate. I can jump right in and I can say the obvious, well, you missed arm side. We're trying to get that pitch over there, try to get that pitch there, or something, you know, physical, keep your front side closed and stay through your target that way. But what if he's already trying to do all of those things and I don't know that? That's where the asking questions comes into play. Hey, what was your intention there? Where were you trying to deliver the ball? Where was your focal point? How were you trying to deliver the ball there? Were you just placing it there, or were you trying to actually throw it through him? So now I can get into, okay, what was your intention? What was your vision of the pitch? What were you actually trying to do? Maybe something popped into his head at the last second that he thought about running away from the hitter, you know, anything like that. But I don't know that unless I'm willing to open myself up and ask the questions to understand where he's coming from. And once I do that, now I can maybe help him to reframe that. Mm-hmm. Okay, you missed the last, let's say pitcher's thrown the last five pitches and he's missed low, right? The easiest thing would be, well, you know, aim a little bit higher. But what if he already is aiming a little bit higher? Let me ask the question. Let me see what he's doing and work from there. I'm not sure if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, no. And then the other area I was going to ask you about, because it's such a common discussion among, you know, baseball coaches and conventions and, you know, curious to find out where you stand with, you know, catchers and pitchers relationships and who's calling the pitches. Are they coming from the dugout? How early do you have your catchers starting to do that? You know, where's the learning process behind this? You know, I get it in the minors. It's a, you know, you have time to develop. So do you guys have more time to empower players?
Absolutely. We don't call pitches except for, you know, if we're trying to have a pitcher really work on his changeup, then we might have to call a few changeups into the catcher. But for the most part, we're letting the catchers and the pitchers take over the game. And because ultimately you get into the big leagues, no pitching coach is calling pitches. And being able to create some awareness, some game awareness, some feel for the game, some flow for the game, trying to instill that mindset and those attributes and that awareness as early as we can.
Yeah, see, I really like that. And I got to believe that you'd be happy if we started doing that, you know, at the younger level. So that way, when they get to you, they got a pretty good sense of, you know, understanding how to call some pitches and how to work with your pitcher and that pitcher, you know, catcher relationship, the trust factors.
Definitely. I mean, I can see where a lot of, especially the bigger time college programs are coming from. You know, I mean, they've got a job to do. They got to win ball games. When you're at a big time Division I type university, it's ultimately, you know, your job depends on what pitch is getting called. So to a certain extent, I do understand that. But, you know, maybe we can develop our catchers at the same time rather than it just being here. I'm going to call every single pitch.
Yeah. You know, and as I'm thinking, you know, maybe one process could be that when we get them at 11, 12, and 13 before the high school process, you know, a lot of coaches that are volunteers that are working with the kids there, if they empowered them a little bit more in making some decisions, you know, maybe not all of them, but making some decisions, I would assume the younger you are and the earlier you're allowed to make decisions, the better player you will be in the future.
Definitely. Couldn't agree more. I mean, I think as you're at those younger, we were just talking about creating awareness that and the failure, and kids are going to be able to adjust and adapt, and it's your job to then step in when they can't, right? As a coach. Mm-hmm. So if pitchers are sitting there throwing 15 fastballs to start a game, hey, why don't we mix in a changeup type thing, right? If he's just getting barreled on everything, you hope that ultimately that failure is going to force the adjustment rather than you having to step in and now you've got to call every single pitch. So then he comes in from the inning and, hey, you can ask him the question, hey, what was maybe one thing you could have done differently? Or what would be one thing that you could have done to get him off of your fastball? Okay, you know, throw a changeup. And part of that becomes kind of obvious, self-obvious and self-evident. But just helping guide that process rather than strictly leading it. I think it's so important to have, especially at the younger levels, an athlete-driven, athlete-led process rather than a coach-led process.
Now, well said. And I noticed during your talk too, you know, and you had a lot on your talk, so we can't cover it all, obviously, but you know, during your talk, you mentioned the new frontier of sports performance and development. One of the things is understanding human behavior. I'm a young coach. I'm out there and I'm listening. You know, most of us tend to start off with the fundamentals and the mechanics and all that, but human behavior is extremely important. Where do I start with that? What's your recommendation? How do I get going and what's important behind this?
There's a ton of layers to it, obviously, as you said, but for the most part, it's understanding, just like we're coming to understand, and the ranch does a great job with these types of things where, you know, there's not one cookie cutter type mechanic for a pitcher. You're not going to teach every pitcher to pitch the exact same. You look in the big leagues and they all look different. The same thing goes for your message and how you deliver your message. You and I might be totally different, competing type personalities, but for most coaches, I think the message gets relayed the exact same way. We try to teach our athletes to be adjustable and adaptable. Are your coaching strategies adjustable and adaptable based on the athlete's personality, based on the situation, whether you're in a game or in a practice, where, you know, how mature that athlete is? Is that athlete really self-conscious or is he really secure? If an athlete's, just as an example, if an athlete's really self-conscious, I'm not going to want to light him up, blow him up, yell at him in front of all of his peers because he's already really self-conscious. I probably just made him even more self-conscious. But what about that leader that's really secure in himself? Players look up to him. I need to hold him accountable. That might be a really good guy to make an example out of in a setting if I'm trying to get all the other players to follow suit. And that's just a really small example, but the understanding human behavior part is really the communication aspect of how you relay your message and ultimately how can you just do it a little bit more effectively. And the first thing is just being aware of it for me.
Yeah, and you talked about earlier about some of this also, but I wouldn't mind rehashing a little bit of this, avoiding coaching corruption. You call that hyper-personalization.
So I kind of stole part of that from Ron and Flint from the ranch, where they talk about training corruption. And training corruption is, you know, in an essence, any drill that you do, if you overdo the drill, you take away the benefits of the drill. Like if the drill just becomes rote and monotonous and all they're doing is going through the movement and not actually applying themselves, not actually doing it with intent, then you're corrupting that training. And the same thing goes with, you know, the idea, okay, if everything we do on the field matters, then every drill that we do, every throw that we make, there needs to be a purpose and an intention behind it. And think about that when it comes to your coaching, when it comes to your communication. You can really corrupt your message. You can really corrupt your relationship with your players and what they receive from you if you don't pay attention to what you say, how you say, and when you say it. You pick a really inopportune time to try to present something to your players, that message isn't going to be received. The message has been corrupted. I can say the very same thing two completely different ways, and one gets received, one doesn't. And I think paying attention to that, if I ask you just very simply, why did you do that? Right? You hear it in my tone. You hear how I said that. You hear how you kind of became defensive, right? And you probably thought about your parents, where your parents would always ask you, why are you doing that, right? Instead of that, if I ask you the question, hey, what was the purpose behind you doing that? You hear it in my tone. My tone is completely different. I ask the same thing, but just in a very different way that maybe made you open up a little bit more. And ultimately, that player-coach relationship, you said the pitcher-catcher relationship, it's not going to be any good if it's not open and it's not honest. So if you're not paying attention to what you say, how you say, and when you say it, you start to corrupt a little bit of that, and then you start to corrupt the open and honest communication that goes on.
And the coaches out there, what about the coaches, you know, assistant coach relationship? What do you think some of the major factors there are, why some coaches are real successful at it and some maybe not as much? And I know you mentioned, and I think in your talk, something about coaching agreement. How do we follow this? Where do we start when we have assistants? What's the pattern to, you know, to go along to make sure that, you know, these guys, that our assistants are happy and that everybody's on the same page?
That is such a great question for so many different reasons, because I think what gets lost in this a lot of times, and even when I talk to coaches or to anybody about this, what gets lost in it is this isn't just player coach relationship. This is coach to coach relationship. This is head coach to assistant coach relationship. It's coordinator to coach relationship in professional baseball, where it's the same exact thing, that nothing changes. You can, as you know, in the minor leagues, you have pitching coordinators or field coordinators that it's the managers and the pitching coaches that are underneath them, that they're basically their bosses. It's the same exact thing. It's the same exact maintaining a relationship, creating a positive relationship where definitely you still have some element of power. You're still their boss, right? Mm-hmm. And being able to not be so buddy-buddy, friendly that you can't hold somebody accountable, but providing them the environment and providing them the freedom that they can be open and can be honest with you in their communication, and that ultimately your message is being received how you'd like it to be received. And the awareness comes with that, paying attention to that, and really practicing it more than anything.
Excellent. And folks out there, we're talking to Jonathan Armold, Texas Rangers minor league pitching coach. And if you want to get a hold of him, get him on Twitter, at 24JNO. JNO is his nickname, Jono. So maybe for the next part of the series of the show, I might call him Jono so we can speed up the process a little bit. So don't forget, try to get a hold of him at, again, Twitter, at or follow him at 24JONO. Jonathan, I don't want to jump right away. I think we can kind of mix this a little bit because you talked about pitching a little bit there as we're talking about coaching at the same time. Is there something that, you know, wasn't said that is so important for coaches to know that we didn't get a chance to cover? Because that's what I'd love to do is give you that opportunity right now to talk about something I didn't mention.
More than anything, you know, I'd say one really great point is listening to your athletes. So you'd mentioned it before I did, actually, about listening. And, you know, I don't mean to sound like some Dr. Phil up here talking about how we need to listen better. But just a great quote that I continuously come back to, and I have to practice myself, is that most people do not listen with the intent to understand. They listen with the intent to reply. And you can even think about how you and I are doing this. You know, you're asking the question and I'm not really hearing your question as much as I'm thinking in advance about how I'm going to answer.
Absolutely. I'm doing the same thing.
and you know, that's readily apparent in this type of a setting. But what about if we go into a coach to coach setting, a player to coach setting, a husband to wife setting? Not that I need to be some relationship counselor by any means, but when you're having a conversation with somebody, it's two ways. Are you actually hearing what the player is saying or what the coach is saying, absorbing it, you know, kind of thinking about feeling where that's coming from, listening to how they're saying it? Because the ability to listen there and not listening with any judgment or thinking, oh man, you're a terrible person because you're saying this, or oh man, you're an idiot because you're saying this, but listening so that then I can come back at you and ask you a question that maybe an athlete in the bullpen says something specific, right? I ask him, hey, what do you feel in there? He throws a couple of pitches. They look really good. Ball's coming out hot and he drills a spot. I ask him, hey, what are you feeling there? What's going on? Like, walk me through that. Those last two have looked really good. And he says some cue mm-hmm. that he uses for himself, right? Oh man, it really felt like I was getting into my legs. Okay, now I can take that and apply that, let's say, when it looks like he's not, right? So now it's not just my words, it's the words that he actually used. And I can take those words and put them into a conversation where they came out of his mouth, so he knows exactly what they are and what he meant by them. So now the cueing doesn't even so much come from me as it actually came from him. And talk about, you know, supplying the environment and more than anything, guiding rather than dictating. That's a large portion of it. That a coach is a skillful listener who'll be able to ask powerful questions.
Yeah, you know what? And now I want to jump a little bit. I'm going to jump to the pitching part for the second half of our show. We're a little bit past the halfway point, but we'll try to do our best to get into the pitching. And, you know, we're not trying to get into everything, but I think I'm going to try to reach out. And, you know, I want you to hit on a couple of key areas when it comes to pitching. First of all, your belief in when kids are getting started and they're going to start to pitch, your belief in some of the areas that coaches, we'll start with the young coaches, need to follow a little bit to make sure that, you know, safety is an issue, to make sure that health is an issue, to make sure that they gain confidence. Because, you know, throwing strikes or getting hitters out is not that as easy as it looks sometimes. So where's a young coach start?
I think first and foremost, understanding, you know, I understand mechanics. I understand movement patterns. I understand all of that. But I think also more than anything, it's the willingness to accept that you also don't know a lot of what you're looking at. You know, I think we look at a lot of even youth pitchers, and you look at him and you're like, oh man, he needs to fix this mechanically. And realistically, again, I look up at the big leagues and I see a lot of pitchers up in the big leagues that have mechanics that I would never teach anybody. And and if that's really the case, and that's the pinnacle of pitching, and that's the pinnacle of being able to get people out, do we really need to spend that much time on mechanics stuff? And then in the same vein, I a lot of youth coaches, and I'm not coming on here at all to bash youth coaches, but I hear so much time spent on mechanics and everything. I do lessons in the off season, and a lot of times young pitchers come to me and they say, oh yeah, you know, pitching coach is working with me on X, Y, and Z in my mechanics, but I also threw in 3 games this weekend. Yeah. And I just think there's so much information out there when it comes to trying to keep young kids healthy and stress fractures in youth pitchers and, you know, unfortunately, ulnar collateral ligament injuries and soft tissue injuries that are going on because kids are pitching 150 pitches over the course of 2 days or unfortunately 1 day. I think, you know, more than anything, you winning that 11U trophy really isn't that important when you look up a month later and you've also got a kid that's now hurt. To me, that's the most important thing. Understanding workload more than anything, and understanding those kids aren't professional athletes, and throwing pitching back-to-back days is probably not going to be very conducive to their career.
Excellent said. I mean, that's really well said. And, you know, a lot of times we'll see guys, and I want you to talk about especially your minor league guys, because, you know, if they're not doing certain things, then certainly our young kids should not be doing certain things. Because, you know, your guys are a lot stronger, more developed, and as they get to the big leagues, they're even stronger and fully developed. During the winter, what's your recommendation? Let's take the cold climates especially. During the winter, what's your recommendation? What do your guys do during the winter to, you know, keep their bodies in shape, keep their arms in shape? When do they start, maybe, you know, starting to throw? You know, because some of these kids throw all year round. I understand playing catch and pitching are 2 different things, but give us an idea what some of your programs are for some of your minor league players.
It's going to be a little bit different for everybody. We're really moving towards a individualization type era where, you know, some kids might need longer time on the mound or on the slope before coming to spring training. So it is a little bit individual. Younger guys might end up going to the Dominican some. That's a little bit more in the fall than the winter. But, you know, they might end up going and pitching in winter ball for guys that feel like they need more in-game development. So the answer to that question is it depends. But we do give some time off, especially, you know, if somebody doesn't want the time off, you know, they can talk to pitching coordinator, talk to a pitching coach, and they can continue to throw year round if it's done in a safe or watched over environment type thing where they're not getting on a mound 12 months out of the year. But, you know, really, it really is individual. We try to give some time off and then have a good on-ramping that, you know, they'll start to throw in at least by December, have a good period of throwing of long toss before they end up hitting the mound in come January, February, whenever their report date is. Our pitching coordinator does a great job with that of scheduling things out and programming for our pitchers in that sense. But if I had to give one advice to other coaches out there, it's the working backwards principle. Okay, our first game is on February 1st. Well, I know I want to get him on a mound, you know, at least 4 times before that. So I got to work 4 times before that. Okay, I know he needs to throw for 4 weeks before that, and kind of backwards programming from there.
Yeah, that works out good. So that way you're working backwards, and then you can go you know what to do forwards. What about any strength and conditioning that you guys do in the off season for your players? That I know it's individualized, but some of the drills that they might be doing, what are they working on mostly?
Yeah, they've got our strength and conditioning staff does an outstanding job. It's been remarkable to watch the last few years that I've been here, just how much bigger, faster, stronger guys are getting. The nutrition has taken, you know, really big leaps forward, and you're seeing that really correlate to on-field performance for guys. So they have full off-season training protocols that they go through where they get a little bit of downtime, where, you know, they can rest and let their bodies recover after a long full season. Mm. But then they start right back up with the lifting stuff even before they start playing catch again, to let their bodies, you know, get back to those areas of strength. And as you said, that's all individualized to what a guy needs. Some guys might need a little bit more lower half, might need more lower half strength. Some might need more lower half flexibility. And our strength and conditioning staff does a great job of programming that stuff for guys.
Is there a certain evaluation that your staff does? So you evaluate the players and then set the program up?
Yes, to my knowledge, that's the way that they largely do it. Again, they're head and shoulders above where I'm at in terms of the strength and conditioning aspect of things. But they do go through, you know, the protocols of, okay, let's test his flexibility, let's test his mobility, his stability, his explosiveness. And then you can start to formulate, okay, this guy needs a little bit more stability stuff. How can we supplement that with the general weight program that we do?
But that information is extremely important to you, because my next question is going to be, you take that information, and now when they first come to you, what's the evaluation process that you go through as their pitching coach to identify their strengths, weaknesses, you know, on a physical part or possibly even on a mental part?
Definitely. And understanding that, Ron does a great job. I hear him talk about it all the time. Are we asking athletes to do things that they're not physically capable of doing? Mm-hmm. And that's where that weight room comes into play. Typically, before I'm trying to make any sort of wholesale changes to an athlete, to his delivery, to anything that he does throwing wise, the first thing I'm going to do is go talk to the trainers. Hey, how's his internal, external rotation? How's his shoulder? How's his elbow? Is there anything that I should be worried about? Is there anything that would be preventing him from already doing what I'm thinking about asking him to do? Yeah. I'll check that box, and then I'll go to the strength staff. Hey, is there any underlying weakness or instability? Is one thing where if I'm looking at somebody's lower half and I'm trying to help him to use his butt more, use his glutes more when he's throwing, use his hips better. Is there some sort of range of motion deficit there that we could try to free up first, where, you know, a lot of times, as I said before, on field pitching coaches, we want to run to the pitching mechanics. And what if I could actually help him with the pitching mechanics without even talking about it? With all we have to do is actually incorporate some more stability drills for him in the weight room. Now he can physically stabilize himself and control his delivery and control his body better on the mound without me even having to tell him to do so. And those are kind of two of the very first things that I'll do before trying to go through and make a change or make an alteration to anything.
So it's a long process. I mean, it's a process, because we don't want to make a mistake. We don't want to just think that, you know, this is what he needs. We want to be pretty sure that's what he needs if we're going to make that change.
Yeah, you're trying to make the most informed decision that you can, and you can't do that without the help of the other people on your staff. And that goes for college guys too. You guys all have athletic trainers. High school guys have athletic trainers, and getting those physical limitations and those physical boxes checked, making sure everything checks out there. And as I said before, you're trying to make the most informed decision that you can without just jumping straight into, here, do this.
Yeah, and you know what? The other area I'd like to discuss is, And I realize that pitching coaches aren't the ones, and whether it be college, professional, they're not the ones who are going to make a decision when a player's pulled out of a game or when a pitcher's make a pitching change. But they give a lot of information to their managers. The question is, a lot of coaches, I believe, struggle with this. One of the hardest things to do. You know, a pitcher's throwing strikes, he's pretty successful, and then all of a sudden he comes back the next inning and he's struggling to find a strike zone. What are your protocols? What do you follow to determine, you know, that we're going to take this pitcher out at this particular time? You know, anybody could take a guy out if they just gave up four runs. But if he's just struggling, you know, at the beginning of that inning, what are you looking for and how are you going to make that decision? I get it. It's a broad question. Sure. There's got to be some parameters that you follow.
I think it's a game, exactly as you're saying, and there's not going to be one specific answer to it, but, you know, it's a game flow thing. It's a, where is he at? So let's say that happens and it's the starting pitcher's fifth inning, and it's actually his first time getting to the fifth inning where we're building him up still, and he's only gone four innings and 60 pitches, and now he's up at 5 and 65, or even 5 and 55. Well, he's done the four, but he hasn't gotten up and down five times yet. So part of that is to be expected, and part of that is you're going to have to let him work through that failure, because if I don't let him work through this, when is he ever going to? And while also not sacrificing the game at the same time and just throwing in the towel into it. And part of that's understanding the workloads. Oh, well, maybe last outing he went eight innings, and maybe his body's still technically trying to recover from some of that. And you don't know that unless you talk to the athlete first off, and you can't communicate with the athlete. But, you know, maybe you go, okay, I take a mound visit and let me just see where he's at from a mindset perspective. Where's his focus? Where is his attention and where is his intention? Has it shifted from the fourth inning where he was dealing to this fifth inning? Maybe all I got to do is reshape and refocus where his attention and where his intention is, and now we're right back on track. It's being adaptable, being flexible in that instance, and trying to use the best judgment that you can while not giving up the game.
Oh, I tell you what, that's where that you were talking about. That's where that human behavior, understanding human behavior, can really come in to help. Because I love that you went to the mound and talked about that, because that's something that, you know, I wouldn't mind if you elaborated a little bit more on when you do go to the mound. You did mention some of the things you're looking for, talking or asking questions. Give our coaches some ideas. What else? What other things have you said to pitchers, and why have you said certain things to them?
In what aspect? Narrow that down for me a little bit.
Well, you know, again, he's struggling, you know, and you go out there, you know, and, or no, let's do this. Even better. You got to take him out.
Okay.
And because he's struggling, give our younger coaches some advice. What do you tell that pitcher?
I'll be honest. I don't tell him very much. If a pitcher, you think about timing of feedback, right? And we talked about this with the coaching corruption. If I have to take a pitcher out, or, you know, typically managers taking a pitcher out, but heat of the moment can a lot of times get the best of us. And I remember that even more so as a pitcher myself, when I was getting taken out, you're probably best to stay away from me. I'm a little bit fiery. I can get heated a little bit at times. You give me an inning or two innings, and we're going to be able to have a rational conversation. But if you come and you try to grab me immediately afterwards and say something to me there, probably not going to be very good, a very good result, especially not if I think I should have stayed in the game, which we know 99% of pitchers always think they should stay in the game. Yeah.
Jonathan, I guess that's why you never ask a pitcher how he's feeling, or do you ask him?
I think you can just to confirm what you think you already know, I guess, where, gotcha. And also to get out in front of it. You ask him, hey, how you feeling? Good. I'm good. And that's where the relationship comes into play too. If you've got a good relationship with them, hopefully they're going to be honest if they're not feeling good. But if you don't have a good relationship with you, they're just going to lie through their teeth to you and tell you that they're good anyways, because they know otherwise you're going to take them out of the game.
Yeah. Well, you know, that also, we got a lot of young coaches on that listen to the show. And I think this is an important topic because it's out there and, you know, we're seeing an increase of injuries, obviously, in pitchers. And we know that the injuries don't occur, you know, when they're big league guys. They occur, obviously, a lot earlier than that. But we also know that it's not perfect. We don't have all the answers of why young kids are getting hurt at an early age. So I want you to address your relief pitchers a little bit. How do you control when they throw, how much they throw? And you mentioned earlier, back-to-back or every other day. Because if you're doing certain things at the minor league level, again, like we talked about, that they're fully more developed athletes, then that gives a pretty good perspective what our younger coaches should be doing because these kids are still not grown and their muscles and so forth and their tendons are not developed.
I'll hit on two things. The first of which is that we don't let our guys, our relievers, throw back-to-back days until they're at least in double A. Now, we're talking double A. To get to double A, you've probably got 3 to 4 years of professional baseball under your belt. That's 3 to 4 years of professional weight training, arm care exercises, 3 to 4 years of professionally building your body. And we don't ask them to do that until they reach that point. And for the most part, you're looking at guys that are 25, 26 years old, maybe even a little bit older. And then you look at the youth level and we're asking 11-year-olds to throw back-to-back days or 2 games in 1 day. And I just think it's unreasonable to do that and then to expect nothing bad to happen from that. Mm-hmm. So part of that is the bounce back aspect and the recovery aspect where, you know, we are trying to protect relief arms and pitchers in general, where, you know, that back-to-back day just doesn't allow for a lot of recovery. So that's one thing. And the second thing that I'd say, and this becomes hard, especially harder as you climb up in the higher levels of professional baseball, but can you allow enough of an on-ramping time, of a warm-up time to your relief pitchers? If you know that, hey, this next inning, if you've got the feel for the game, the feel for your pitchers that I don't know that my starter is going to make it out of this upcoming inning, this next inning, I can tell whatever relief pitcher I'm thinking about using, hey, just so you know, an inning and a half in advance, there's a chance that, you know, you might have to come in the middle of that inning. It, as much of a forewarning as I can give, that means the more that he can let his body get loose before he's even got to start cranking his arm. And we all know cardiovascular wise, you know, the more blood that you can get pumping before you even crank your arm up, hopefully the better and the more dissipated the force is going to be throughout the body. You know, giving enough time for warm up, for body warm up, for throwing warm up, and then finally, okay, time to get on the mound for two reasons. First, from an injury perspective, and also from a, they don't have to get on the mound and throw 35 pitches. Maybe it just takes them 10 because they just did a full body warm-up. And I know they did their bands or they did, you know, whatever their warm-up protocol type thing is.
You know, and that brings up, you know, that I love you talked about all that because I think that relates really well to our coaches working with our young kids. Because if they hear that, then, the doorbell rings and says, whoa, hang on a second. I got to really watch out what I'm doing with these young kids. So thanks for going over that. And that brings up the point of, and I know there's a podcast, so you can't visually, you can't see anything, but give us an idea because they can also go down to the young levels. They just don't have to do as much possibly, but give us an idea. The kid comes in and, you know, he's not going to hit but he's going to pitch the next inning. What can he do to get warmed up? Or what do some of your guys do to get warmed up quickly? You mentioned bands. Anything else that you recommend that can be done that can really help speed up the warm-up process?
One of the best things that I ever found was just running back and forth. It sounds so stupid and so simple, but doing runs back and forth. You can sit there and you can run from the top of the mound to home plate and run back and forth 4 times. And you got a little bit of a lather going. You got a little bit of a sweat going. And now I go into maybe arm circles or some band work before I even have to start my throwing. And, you know, in an ideal world, you could go through a full set of a dynamic warm-up. Mm-hmm. that hopefully all coaches are going through before your practice. But by the time that relief pitcher has been sitting there for six innings, that dynamic warmup you went through before the game started has kind of worn off. So maybe if you can even give enough time, they can go back through that full body, full dynamic warmup, you know, the rugbies or whatever you call them, before even having to get into the actual arm care warmup type stuff. So body warmup and then arm care warmup, and then we get into the throw.
Sure, and young kids can do that because they know they do the warmup, like you said at the beginning. They can take some of that stuff, and then running back and forwards, you know, like you talked about, isn't that hard. They can understand all that. I'm trying to give some of our young coaches an idea of what they should be doing. At least they're doing something compared to doing nothing and just picking up a ball and throwing. I think that's the thing that really hurts them more than anything. They think,
sure,
their arms are okay just because they, you know, they can throw.
Definitely.
You know, the other part is, I remember being an independent ball, we used to chart everything, you know, as far as pitches. And I know there's a difference between throwing, you know, a pitch and throwing a pitch in a game under stress. What do you guys do when it comes to chart? Do you chart bullpen? How many pitches they throw? Do you chart anywhere else?
We don't really chart. We'll keep track of it, especially if it becomes a really heavy bullpen or a really light bullpen, which we'll call a touch and feel. That's not a full side or a full bullpen. Mm-hmm. But we've got these things, we call them grids. And basically anytime a pitcher is off a mound, we chart it and we have it on us as coaches, especially because we have to communicate it to our pitching coordinator. But we have, anytime they get on a mound sidewise, anytime they get, let's say, hot in the bullpen, and they don't get in the game, we write that down. So it is something that's monitored. We're just trying to do the best that we can from monitoring a workload perspective. And that's even easier at the youth level where, you know, you're not playing 7 days a week. You've got maybe three games a week. It just takes a little bit of effort to write down, okay, he threw three innings, 50 pitches this day. I want to try to give him at least 3 days to rest up to be ready for the next game. And if you do a simple grid or a chart like what you're saying, it's just a really good way to keep track of that.
Sure. All right, man. I'll tell you what, this has been a great show. It's really flown by and you're giving some great information. I want to leave it with this. This is your time. I usually do it with all our guests on the show. Leave it as anything about pitching or anything else in general that we may have missed out on that you just think was so vital to bring up that you need to talk to our audience about. It's your time. Let it roll, and then we'll finish it up.
Nothing really, to be honest. I think we hit on so much stuff. I think maybe one thing that I've got as for coaches is, You have to know yourself as a coach in order to know your players. Where do you know your philosophy forwards and backwards, where you've written it down? A really great book that I read by Pete Carroll that he wrote a while ago was Win Forever. And in there, he talked about how he'd been coaching at the collegiate level. I mean, we're talking high-level collegiate athletes. And he got interviewed for a job and they asked him, you know, what's your philosophy? And he could verbalize it, but it wasn't to a T. And he came away from it and he goes, I've got to write this stuff down. I've got to be able to know this, you know, lock and key of what I believe in, who I am as a coach, what I want to try to do. And my challenge to coaches would be, what is your philosophy? And can you specifically articulate exactly what that is? Write it down. And it adjusts and it adapts over time and it grows as you grow as a coach. But being able to write that down and being able to know who you are is going to help you so much with knowing your athletes at the same time.
All right. Great advice, man. Jonathan Armold, Texas Rangers pitching coach. He has been with the Texas Baseball Ranch, also with Ron Wolfert. Just outstanding, outstanding show. Jonathan, listen, two things. One, I know they can, you know, our audience can get a hold of you on Twitter, follow you on Twitter at 24JONO. Anywhere else that they can get a hold of you at?
Yeah, please send me an email, jarmold at texasrangers.com. If anybody needs anything, any help that I can provide, by all means.
All right, man. Listen, I'm glad I get a chance to follow your career a little bit because you've really come a long way. So I want to wish you the best with the Rangers, and I'll try to stay in touch. Again, thanks for being on the show, Jonathan.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
All right, to all our listeners out there, thanks for being a life learner by listening to the show that educates people in the game. Don't forget to follow us at Baseball Out on Twitter. Follow us. You get a lot of great information. And also our website, baseballoutsidethebox.com. If you can do us a favor and forward that website to everybody in the game, that just helps everybody get more educated. And don't forget, email me at info@baseballoutsidethebox.com. Thank you to Brian Crock, our producer. Thank you to Jonathan Armel, Texas Rangers pitching coach. And remember, coaches, education is the key to building the foundation of our sport. So keep getting smarter by listening to the show that interviews baseball's best coaching minds with innovative thoughts that love to challenge the status quo. I'm your host, Pete Caliendo. Have a great coaching day, and we'll see you on the next show.
This has been Baseball Outside the Box with Peter Caliendo. Listen online at baseballoutsidethebox.com and subscribe on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and all major podcast outlets. Join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Get all of our podcasts now at lineupmedia.fm. This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.